The lights are on red. We're away.
Internet radio show all about motorcycle road racing. This is episode number 243 for Friday, the 3rd of September 2010. My name is Jim Race. I am here with Jules Chisak, both of us in California, returned from the wonderful state of Indiana. How are you doing, Jules?
All right.
Good. This is going to be an interesting show for us. Obviously, we were at the track and got all sorts of good things. It's also quite clear that there's no simple way to say it. It was also a horrific weekend for us and for you guys out there, not only in MotoGPOD land, but kind of across the racing community. And so I think it's only fair that we should talk about that a little bit. And if either of us chokes up, we hope you'll forgive us. But before we do that, just want to throw out a quick thanks. And if I forgot anybody here, my vast apologies. But in the midst of the chaos that was the GP, wonderful chaos, most of it, Christina Sua, who I jokingly have now referred to as our token forgotten chick. Christina, I know you're going to kill me for that. Very nicely sent in a donation. Thank you very much. On top of that, we got to, you know, before we even drop into the news, Jules, let's go ahead and recount, because we had a really killer meetup with the MotoGP OD fans out there, didn't we?
Yeah, it was, Indy was always a good meetup, because I think that it's just more better attended than Laguna.
Sure.
So, and it's also easier to find the pagoda and the yard of breaks there. But man, we had a great turnout. Thanks for everyone who came out. We handed out pretty much all the stickers we had. Met some great characters that we've, you know, talked to many times. A lot of familiar faces, a lot of new faces. It was great. It's really great.
It was really fun to, you know, just kind of walking around the circuit, the vastness of what that place is. And I remember on, I think it was Sunday morning, I wandered over by the vendor area and I just sat down underneath an umbrella. And gentleman, I want to say his name is Jeff. He'll remind me. Jeff, Dave. I plopped down with the beer and it was a little bit, well, it was noon somewhere. He said, "Hi, Jim." And I looked over and I'm like, "Hey, how you doing?" And he said, "I met you in 2008 when you guys did the meetup here," and just popped in my head. I'm like, I didn't really mention it to him at the time, but I'm like, yeah, that's really cool. You know, a couple of years later and just still sticks in the mind. He's still a fan. He still listens, introduced me to his wife and, little things like that. Yeah. We had some folks that, this was their third year at the meetup and they mentioned that and, so very cool. And we saw some people also that we saw from Laguna, as well as Big John Hart.
Yeah. Finally get to meet Big John.
Yeah, and there's been some cool pictures out there. We never did get the full lineup picture, but folks, if you took pictures and you haven't put them anywhere where we can see them or whatever, feel free to send them into the show through the contact address, or you know, drop us an email and we can let you know how to get us the nice high res ones personally. Right.
Yep. And, one thing that was kind of interesting is that I think a lot of people are unclear about where Bob is. So we'll just need to, go through that again. Bob is in Afghanistan. He's a, he's been in the Navy Reserve, for many, many years. He's been to, Iraq and Kuwait in the past. And, now he's made a chief. So he's responsible for a bunch of guys that are out there in Afghanistan, you know, fighting the fight.
Yep.
And that's where he is. That's why he's not at Laguna meetup. He was not at the Indy meetup. He's actually is over in Afghanistan now. His training has ended at the end of July, I believe, or mid-July. I got one email from him saying, "This place sucks."
Yes. Exactly. Yes, this is not a working vacation. Bob is off, you know, and enjoying the fruits and massive income that MotoGPOD does generate. but instead, he is off in the sand and in a place where he'd much rather not be. The sad part about it is Bob being such a fan is that he basically gets none of this, and so we kind of have to be very circumspect whenever we talk to him in email or anything, or at least I always am, and not, you know, spoiling him.
Right. Yeah. Actually, I send him DVDs of the races, but man, he's behind.
Yeah.
Because the DVDs take like a month and a half to get there. So
it's like the old days of getting Duke VHS tapes when you want.
Right.
20 years back. Well, you know, it is what it is. So we certainly do miss Bob, and we can't wait to have him back, and look forward to having him participate in the show in whatever way that he would like to, and frankly take it over so that you and I can go on vacation for a while.
And I, but not to Afghanistan.
And no.
For all those people who did ask about him, I did send him an email saying there were a lot of people just, you know, asking, and then when they found out, you know, sending good wishes. So I sent him an email. Hopefully we'll hear back from him at some point soon.
Indeed. And so episode number 243. Certainly we were at the track, and many thanks to Dorna. We had, once again, fantastic access. That's your third one on the bounce, Jules. You must be a little bit giddy.
Well, it was the second one on the bounce with the right credentials, because yeah. Laguna didn't have them. You had them, but they don't. But it wasn't until Indy that MotoGPOD officially had a journo and a photo and a photog.
Indeed,
that's cool.
And it, I will just to give you a little short blurb. Looks like that is going to continue going forward, and we'll have news on that in the future. But since we were there, we thought, you know, we would take the opportunity to talk to a few people. And so this is yet once again going to be one of those shows where you're going to hear a lot of familiar voices.
It was an interesting weekend from the start, because we had in the past always at least one day of rain, lots of iffy weather. The weather was not iffy. The weather was just hot and clear. And the only thing that that really actually – but the weather did play havoc, because it got – so hot that the track started to, you know, get slippery and slippier as the weekend went on. And one of the people that we are going to hear from is someone that Jim talked to, I think, three or four times. Mm. And then eventually paid the price of the greasiness.
Indeed. So we'll just put those in, and you guys will get the mood as the weekend goes on. The weather on Thursday was fantastic, and Friday was nice as well. It started going downhill from then, but I was expecting, when I went out there at least a week or so prior, that it was going to be classic Midwest heat and humidity, and frankly it was just gorgeous on Thursday and Friday. Thursday was a really fun day at the track. You didn't make it out till Friday.
Yep.
Thursday was just so incredibly mellow. Hardly anybody there, you know, no general public stuff. And just wandering around, everybody was very loose, very open. And that may have now live at the top of one of my favorite days at the track. Just very, very cool. You know, caught up with a whole bunch of people. Very nice to have the opportunity to, and this is also great for the show, to see people relatively closely together. It's nice when people recognize you when they see you more than, you know, once a year. So big fun. Did miss a fair amount of people that weren't able to make it out to Indy, but I'm sure we'll see you at the next races as they come around. We do want to thank our listeners very clearly from the bottom of our heart. As you guys well know, we had an interview on from last week with Peter Lenz, and I don't think there's anybody that really needs a recap of the weekend's events. I don't think Jules and I really feel like doing one. But it's clear that you guys are very, very much passionate about the events of the weekend and kind of understand how we feel. Just a bunch of empathy. And I really appreciated that, Jules. I'm sure you did too.
Very much. The amount of email that we got about Peter, and you know, it's not just, oh man, I'm sorry to hear it, but just stories, lots of great stories. I met Michael and Peter here, or I heard the show and I started reading about Michael and Peter, and so thank you very much for writing in, and it was tough, but we're not going to get too much into it. I think that one of the best, if you want to read a really good kind of wrap up of what happened and what it means, kind of David Emmett kind of summed it up in the perfect way on Moto Matters, as he always does. Just head on over there and read his article. I think it was one of the best articles about the accident that happened.
He did do a great job. And as I've actually learned this last week, I kind of knew it before, but it is, I think, to some extent, there's an awful lot of people that have learned over the years, as MotoGPOD has had Peter on, Peter and Michael, of the kind of person he is and the kind of racer that he was. And I think you, Bob, myself, do take a little bit of pride in that, and also a bit of chagrin at the same time.
Yeah, we're not going to spend too much time on going through the events. We're all kind of shocked and saddened. And there is anybody who is interested in helping the family out. There's a memorial fund that was organized by a whole bunch of people close to the family, the Lenz family. We have a link to that. It's peterlenz.org as opposed to peterlenz.com, which is the racing site. And we ask that you go there, and if you can then donate to the memorial, and you'll get some really cool little 45 forever stickers that were designed by Chris Crizell.
And it will help the family out, because this is an expensive time for them. So I've already sent into both that one and the one that Liam has organized, and so.
So obviously we're all over the place because it's just difficult to talk about it. So why don't we go in and talk about the other events of the weekend?
Yeah, not only that, but they came in kind of a particular order, which was kind of weird. And why would that be weird? Well, it actually makes a difference to the silly season weirdness that we were talking about in the prior week. There are little bits and pieces falling into place, but the bombshell, Ducati announced over the weekend that they are not going to be participating in World Superbike, at least not at the factory level, starting as of next year. How long that extends, nobody knows. And I think a lot of people went, oh, whoa.
Wow.
Yeah.
I mean, a few years ago we had the Ducati Cup. And now we're going to have a series. I mean, and that referred to the time when, Ducati kind of had an unfair advantage, I guess.
Yeah.
Everybody felt, and they were winning championship after championship. And now, for the first time in how many years? I think that Ducati's been there since the 916 was introduced, right?
I go back to 851 days, I believe.
I think 851. There may have been a year in between, but yeah, you're right. I think maybe the full history of World Superbikes and that is, which has been around for about 25 years, right?
Indeed. And of course, that is a shocker. I have a feeling this is a temporary thing to some degree. It's a combination, I believe, this is my personal opinion, that not only is the 1198 long in the tooth, Xerox clearly is probably not very happy with them and the results that they've had of late, and they're going to kind of wait and see. It's clear that There is something going on in the factory that is like looking at a forward ahead proposition. There is also some talk that they're trying to potentially, and I'm not sure how accurate this is, reposition themselves as not so much of a race bike company, but as more of a, well, you know, everybody wants to sell bikes. Everybody's jockeying for marketing position right now. I mean, that's just what it is, you know?
I mean, that's always been what it is, isn't it?
Well, it is, but it's not always been that way with Ducati. They sell bikes based on, for the most part, based on the racing history. That's a tradition there, is it not?
True, but they do have a racing. They're still racing in MotoGP, and they just signed Valentino Rossi.
Well, and so that's the other bit of the pie. And the first assumption that everybody made is that, well, they can't afford to go World Superbike racing because Valley's so expensive. There's probably a fair bit of truth to that, or at least it is a part of the reasoning. That being said, they haven't completely pulled out because their intent is still to supply the satellite teams that have been, in some ways, resoundingly beating them, at least in the championship points position within World Superbike this year. So we might even see more privateer 1198s on the grid next year, which is kind of an interesting proposition. You know,
it makes a lot of sense for Ducati to do at least 1 year prior to the 2012 MotoGP rule changes, where they concentrate just on this Ducati Rossi project, right? So it's not just about cost; it's also about, you know, just resources.
Well, yeah.
In general, right?
Yeah.
But I have to say, I think that means it's the end of Haga's career.
I would agree. But I don't think it's necessarily precipitated by Ducati leaving. I think this was probably going to be the last year for Nori anyway.
Yeah. But this is definitely a nail in the coffin, you know?
It looks to me, if I had to guess, I would say that he will retire and. Or maybe not, you know, I have heard things about offers from other manufacturers. I think it's all up to Nori at this point, is it not?
Of course. Yeah. Of course. But yeah. Yeah. I mean, yeah, it's true. He probably would not have been staying at the team anyway, considering how poor his results were. Well, you know, he was still leaning Fabrizio in his standings, so it's not like he's completely slouching.
No. You know, it is what it is, but it also creates a bit of a sticky wicket for the, you know, there was potential for Colin Edwards to be heading there.
That is another one. Yeah, I was just going to say, mention that. All those rumors about Colin going there were basically tied to the Xerox Ducati team.
Right.
And but now it looks like he's going to stay one more year in MotoGP,
which I think's very cool. Colin was in rare form this weekend at the races. for those of you that haven't got the Thursday press conference, I highly suggest you do. It was classic Colin, but a little bit even over the top for him. And I know that it is available out there in full glory. The transcript is available across the net if you just want to read it. And I will tell you that the press room was rolling. Dan Lowe was in the back of the room shooting it. Those of you that can go to cornerspeedphoto.com, I believe, and see Dan's shots from in there. He was basically pointing his camera, because Colin was being so funny, at Ben Spies to catch the rare but outrageous Ben Spies grin. So yeah, Colin, yeah, does sound like he's going to say, hopefully stay at Tech Toi. There's all but signed. I heard from a lot of people over the weekend that Cal Crutchlow is going to be at Tech 3. I say going to be, not is, because it's not a done deal yet until, you know, somebody stamps the thing valid.
which of course, you know, we're forgetting to mention the most important news, which is that on Friday, it was announced that Ben Spies is in fact joining Jorge Lorenzo at Fiat. Although actually, you can't really say joining, because because Jorge hasn't officially signed yet. But you know,
yeah, and of course, Jorge not officially signing yet throws kind of a not a wrench, but a there is still the you know fight for money, both with Pedrosa and Honda, and for Jorge with Yamaha, and they're going to play that to the hilt. You know it. In fact, they may actually cooperate. They might be calling each other, going, should we wait till Thursday?
Yeah.
We'll see.
But we are going to have Spies in the factory team, as everybody expected, and we were quite sure, and then it was eventually confirmed that he did run a factory motor in that in his bike.
Yeah, really? Are you sure about that?
I think something tells me that he did have that extra 1,000 RPMs.
It was clear that he had a little kick. I mean, okay, so let's talk about qualifying just a little bit. Well, FP1, FP2, those went along relatively well, but do have to mention that the weekend was a bit of a crash fest, and in fact, Valentino Rossi now has a new record.
Right, that's right, for himself anyway.
Yes, for himself. That being, I believe, 4 crashes over the space of 1 race weekend. Or at least in this class, you might be able to go back further. Probably to the pocket bite days, that might be just 1 day. we had a fair amount of crashes, but things kind of evened out. And to be honest, the weather for QP was pretty good. It was hot, but it hadn't really reached that greasy state at that point.
And the track is, some people call the track a bit bumpy. And why don't we have one of those people talk about that?
I think we should, in fact. We could probably even run 2 of those, the pre on the thing, and then we'll get both Casey and Nikki's ideas post FP1. Yeah, let's roll into that.
Nothing, to be honest. I'm trying to think of something, but no. I mean, I haven't been here last year, but it's not a problem at all. I think you know, we felt quite comfortable with the circuit in 2008. We found some new things in Brno that we're going to try here, but whether they're going to work or not, we're not sure. We use a new model of forks that Olin's brought to us in Czech Republic. I think a lot of teams were testing, but we found a very similar feeling to what we had at the beginning of the season. So I'm not really sure if they're going to work or not. We're just going to have to run them in the first couple of practices, see if we can get an understanding, see if we can get a feeling, and see if we'll decide to run them for the race or not. But if we can use these forks, then they might give us a small advantage, but only really in feeling, not for anything else. You know, just to be a little easier on a bumpy circuit like this, and we'll see. But at the moment, yeah, we haven't got anything new for this race. We're just going to have to hope that we can arrive to have a good setting and try and be competitive again, because we just haven't been able to run up front. I mean, we asked, you know, it wasn't like, okay, yeah, you can have this for the rest of the season, because in theory, I mean, it's
a semi-test.
Should be, yeah. But I mean, in theory, normally most of the teams will leave this because they cannot get 2 sets. Maybe they leave it for 2011 when they can have, you know, 2 sets for every bike and have consistency. But at the moment, we're just going to try and have a bit of a back-to-back comparison. And if we can get this fork working quite well, then, yeah, I mean, it's okay just to have 1 fork with this, and the other fork we'll try to run with the standard.
Well, the bike different.
It could
or
be,
or
but
the difference is small.
No, it's quite a big difference in feeling and maybe the way we set up a little bit. It can be quite a big problem having 2 different sets of forks, 2 different bikes, but at the same time, we're just looking for some time at the moment. You know, we've been able to get a good race set up every weekend, but we can't do anything better than what we got. So we're going to have to look for something new and try and get some more speed. So we're willing to take risks. No, for me, the feeling of the fork in general is not a very big difference between 2010 and the 2011 fork. It's quite similar. Between 2009 and this is the same difference between 10 and 9. The biggest thing is just the internals. Supposedly there's a little bit less hydraulic feeling and more more use of springs rather than hydraulics. So in theory, this should give us a lot more feedback, and when I do go to close the front, maybe I can pull it back a bit, and we can just get a little bit more understanding when the front decides to push past the limit, because with the 2010 fork, we just didn't have this feedback. So hopefully with this fork, we can get a little bit more feedback. You don't compromise for any particular type of tarmac. I mean, you know, if one part's 90 and the other part's 10, of course, you know, it's one setup might be slightly different, but most of the time you're just setting up for bumps or, you know, different styles of corners, things like this, more than so much a tarmac type. So yeah, I mean, it's there's never a problem. We've ridden a lot of tracks with a lot of different tarmacs, even if it's the same tarmac around the whole circuit. There's different grip levels in every circuit we go to, so there's it's not something we consider setting up for. We don't have anything, you know, myself, Nick, and we don't have anything, you know. Even in the past years, sometimes we would have the 2011, but I mean, in 2007 to 2008, we didn't have anything new. In 2008, they had to try the new carbon chassis for the next years to ask me if it was better than the previous years, and for sure it was better than the previous years. So normally we go a couple of years without testing anything new in the middle of the season. We just, you know, we had a new fairing in section ring, and that's about it for the year. You know, it's pretty much like normal. You know, we don't really get anything new during the season. And it'd be nice if we did, but that's something that unfortunately Ducati struggle with you know, they need to be a slightly bigger company to try and fix these problems a little quicker, but unfortunately they don't have the resources or the manpower.
You know very well the bike, and you think if Valentino will test after Valencia, it could be a big advantage, a big help for him or for the European about it?
I think it's going to be a big help for Ducati if he can test at the end of the season. Of course, himself as well to spend the 2 months.
Because it's difficult to understand the bike or for other reasons?
Just because, you know, from the end of the season until the beginning of next season, they have a lot of time to make parts, things like this, if something needs to happen. And normally that's what they do is, you know, you get every bit of data you can from the Valencia test, and then of course, with those 2 months, they go away and do as much work and thinking about everything as they can before they come back to the next test next year. So I think it can be quite important for them to get that first test underway. And then, of course, when we have the test ban period, they can do as much work as possible over that period to get ready for the next year. I mean, people are always saying this, but, you know, rookies can come in and be competitive with almost no testing, so I don't think it's necessary. The more tests we have never seems to change the outcome of the beginning of the season. I mean, people that have too much testing end up becoming maybe too confused with things. Of course, you know, if it was 2 days testing before the first race, then maybe we've got a problem. But with the amount of testing we have now, nothing's going to change. If we add another 4 or 5 or 6 days to it, the end result is not going to change before the first race. At the moment, it's a compromise for, you know, this period that we're in. You know, it'd probably help if we could go to another circuit rather than Sepang twice and then Qatar. So at least have, you know, 3 different circuits that we test at, to test the same circuit twice. It's not necessarily the best thing. So yeah, 1 or 2 more circuits, you know, 3 or 4 2-day tests would be great, because we don't get anything now at the end of the season. Normally it's too cold at the end of the season anyway, but yeah, I mean, if we don't get a decent Valencia test, say at the end of this year, and then of course everyone's going to need that extra couple of days at the beginning of next season. You know, there's a few tracks this year that I thought if it's going to happen, it would happen there, but we're still more or less the same position, you know, where we just can't close that gap. And yeah, I mean, we're trying a few more things this weekend. We're trying some alien setups that we've never really tried before, and you know, it's not really something I'm looking forward to, but if it works, then yeah, that's fantastic. But yeah, I don't know if this weekend's going to be any different for us or not, but we'll go out there with the new forks and a few new ideas in our head and see if we can pull something else out of the bag. Just general geometry settings, but nothing that we can jot down on paper. It's a bit too complicated. We didn't have time to back-to-back compare them in Saxon Ring, so we just put them on. I didn't really feel much of a difference, possibly at very high speeds. It kept the front down slightly. But at very high speeds, normally the bike doesn't have enough power to wheel stand anyway. So it was only a help as we come over the fast over the hill in Saxon Ring and the waterfall. In Laguna, we tried to do a back-to-back. We didn't find any difference. They wanted me to run them, so I ran them. You know, that was a nice short track. There's not enough speed, really, to keep the front down again, to have any issues with it. And same at the last track, you know, where it's a nice, big, fast, open track. You're not really having too many issues with wheel stand anyway because there's just not quite enough power to drag it out on fast corners. So, yeah, we're running it just because... Yeah, I mean, yesterday went all right. You know, everything's been doing okay all season. You know, we've started out sessions quite well. We've started out weekends well in the past. But unfortunately, just not transferred it into, you know, into a great result. So, you know, hopefully this weekend can be different. But we just need to keep working and see what everybody else can come out of the bag with. Because, you know, it's first day at a circuit like this. Everyone sort of takes their time to really get going, so we'll have to see what everybody's capable of tomorrow. New forks, like I've said the whole time, is that, you know, they're very similar to the forks that we started out at the beginning of the year. You know, there's a few minor differences that maybe give us a little bit more feedback than what they did before, and hopefully that can give us a difference, because the forks we've been running since the beginning of the year have been fantastic, but on the particularly bumpy circuits, it makes things a lot more difficult, and we're just trying to sort of solve those issues. And, you know, hopefully these new forks can be the difference, but we're just willing to take a risk at the moment. We're willing to see what we can do, and hopefully it works out in our favour. Well, since the beginning of the season, that was that's what we noticed with the new model of forks, and like I said, these are exactly the same feeling-wise, and that's what we had problems with the forks have been running up until now. On all the bumpy circuits, we've been struggling a lot more than everyone, so we decided to try it, you know, especially for this circuit. You know, Bruno even was a little bit bumpier than the past, and yeah, I mean, in general the feeling was quite a bit better, and yeah, we're just going to have to wait and see. Honestly, I have no idea. We did one session and nobody's really up to speed yet, so we'll just have to wait and see what happens. No setups in particular, anything much different to what we've been running most of the season. Like I said, the forks are the biggest risk we're taking this weekend at the moment. If we really need to find a heck of a lot more speed or a better feeling, then yeah, we might try something completely different. But we're, you know, in some of these next races, yeah, we'll try something. And it was scheduled to try something really unique in the Bruno test, but unfortunately when it came back it started raining, so we've got a couple of things to try, but you know, we're not holding out for them to give us the extra speed and the extra confidence. I mean, you know, we know generally a layout of the circuit, we know, you know, how a bike's going to roughly react on a certain type, whether it's fast corners, slow corners, heavy braking or not. So we had enough data from our weight just to sort of start with in general. We'll normally start, there'll be, you know, three or four different groups of circuits throughout the year that we go, okay, this sort of setup works for these circuits in general, so we'll start for that rough idea, and, you know, that's how we start every weekend. We'll know from previous years what roughly works on this style of circuit, and then we just go from there, you know, and progress from that. Out of the box, it wasn't great, no. We tried one setting and completely went the wrong way, and it felt horrible. Then we came back and tried to go in a different direction, made another step, made it feel a little better, and we tried the last exit to make another improvement, but sort of went backwards again. So we've just got to now sort of go back and forward until we find that point where, you know, we're getting all aspects of the bike working well together. I mean, you know, one of the bumpiest circuits I've ever ridden, Silverstone, and you know, except for the fact this is a shorter circuit, it's rivaling it pretty well. I mean, it's bad. You know, some of the bumps, ask Ben. I'm sure he'll tell you he crashed on the exact bumps where there's some really bad ones, and it just seems like it's not a world class circuit. It's maybe the shape of it and everything can be, but the surface definitely isn't. And you know, if you go for a walk up to that last corner, and if you look at the entry point of the last corner, it looks like we're going through someone's garage. There's concrete there. It's not tarmac. And then you all of a sudden you come back into tarmac, and then there's a big seam there that's there's nothing, and it just doesn't feel like a Grand Prix circuit at all. So
has it always been about this bad, or has it gotten worse?
I'd say it's gotten worse since the other year. Bumps, especially in, I don't know what turn it is, after the first hairpin, long, fast left, and then the next one where Ben crashed. That's got a lot worse, and the last part of the circuit's got a lot worse as well. Midsection's quite similar, and the first part in general is pretty good. You know, turn one, turn two, turn three, everything feels quite good, but then after that it sort of just falls to pieces again, and there's big cracks through the circuit and a lot of chattery bumps, things like that. It's not a circuit you can really just push the limit out of. It's a circuit you just have to manage it, you know, miss that bump to, you know, maybe go inside it or outside it, not really take the right line, things like that. And it just doesn't seem quite nice enough, you know. Laguna's in a lot better condition than this, and a lot more fun in a lot of ways than this. I mean, if you get offline, but it's the same in Qatar, it's the same in a lot of circuits. If you get offline, it can be a little bit dusty, and you know the grip level isn't there. But once you stay online here, you know, everybody, you saw him laying a lot of rubber, so you know the grip doesn't feel too bad on when we're sitting in the right position. So at the moment, no problems. Resurface 70% of the track. Simple as that. I mean, the track layout is not the worst. You know, it can be okay. I don't think there's a lot of overtaking opportunities here. It sort of flows one corner into the next too much, and there's no real braking points. There's one actual real braking point. You know, it's difficult to make any overtakes, but I think a lot of the circuit they need to have a big think about, because, you know, I think there's a lot of national circuits around the world that are a heck of a lot better than this, surface-wise. You know, this is a fantastic facility. You know, it's a... it's great to come here with the name of Indianapolis, but it's the track's not doing it justice. So, you know, I think they could do a much better job. There's no real braking points here. They're all, it's like you say, in some ways, other than the back straight, which, you know, it's not much of a straight to get a run on someone. It's out of a kind of flowing corner, you know, you have to get a lot better run. And then going into that left-hander off the end of the back straight's about the only real passing opportunity other than getting a slipstream in the front straight. You know, every other corner goes from left into right, and it's just all... It's not big wide open stuff that you can shove your nose in, you know. It's just corner after corner, and there's no space, no opportunities. So I think, you know, you've really got to sort of force your way through anywhere, and most of the corners are pretty quick. So, you know, I don't know if anybody's really willing enough to risk it. But if you get stuck behind somebody here, you know, it could end up being quite a lot of trouble for you in the race. I was rider error caused it to tip over, but you know, actually it started out quite good. The bike felt good, and I was going pretty decent with had a hard tire on the rear, and I put on a soft tire and felt quite a lot better immediately, and was started pushing the front a bit, but I just made a little mistake and tipped over, and took forever to get back in. I mean, we went out under a tunnel, back under another tunnel, around a golf course. I think we were on the cart path, and then we came back in, and by the time I got back in and got back out, there was no, my leathers had completely ground through, so they had to tape those up, and there was no time, but the bike felt okay, and you know, obviously we need to be in them 40s, but you know, I got in a little bit hot and was just offline, and you know, it was Friday afternoon, so I thought, you know, don't try to force it and stay. I kind of let it go a little bit, thinking I'd just run wide, and just down I went, you know. Certainly, I mean, it is bumpy in that corner, and offline's not good, but no, it went pretty easy on me, but you know, it's not the first one of those I've had this year, so. Well, as soon as I went down, you know, I think that's what I did. I tried to protect my wrist, so I dug my elbow in and did that, but I don't think I did any worse, you know. My arm got hot just because it burned through, but I got back to the box, and the physio was like, well, is your wrist okay? I was like, well, I mean, it hurt before I went out, so it still hurts, but I don't think worse or nothing. It wasn't really a problem, too, so.
Is it mainly just painful under braking? you know, a little bit the bike straight away the first few laps, but really once I got going, I wasn't having big. I had it taped up pretty good. So, yeah, I mean, I got up and was out of the corner of my head. I heard it still running, and I took off after, and had to shut it down because obviously the engines. I've lost one engine, and that was the. Had a different fork setting on that bike. Really, the plan was to only. That wasn't a bike. I was save that one for the race, right. And I was supposed to be practicing the other one, but you know, try out one run. And when I got over there, the handlebar broke off and was up under it, so it wasn't like I could just hit the button. I had to look, and the handlebar was all spun around. There's about a, you know, two or three switches on that bar that looks the same when it's turned around backwards. So I had to start hitting butt. Finally, shut it down.
That's one that had quite a bit of miles left on it.
Yeah, but it looks okay. It was still running, but I mean, it had oil pressure, so that's the main thing. They got to see if anything got sucked in the exhaust, which, you know, when I left the box, they didn't know yet.
I'm not sure if you already answered this, but did you switch forks after Bruno, after the test?
After the test, no. I tested some different forks there, but no, I didn't use them. I have them. We might try them tomorrow, but tried a different fork setting on one bike.
A couple of the riders are complaining the track's bumpier than last year. What's your feeling?
Yeah, it was pretty bumpy last year. It's pretty bumpy this year. Really only about two little spots. Few spots are perfect. I mean, there's a couple bumps out there, but, I mean, it is. I mean, I don't think it's all so bad we load up and go home or nothing like that or. You know, might look at it in the future, but
Casey said 70% recently needs to be resurfaced.
Is that why he was going so slow today? I mean, I'd say 70% of our tracks, you know, we could resurface them all, you know, so. Yeah, if they want to resurface it, great, but I mean, I didn't think it was that bad.
Those were great, weren't they?
Yeah, definitely, definitely. Nikki is playing with Stoner, but
yeah, you and I actually had fun listening to those back through the your laptop, kind of listening to the mood change a little bit as the weekend goes on.
Yep, definitely.
Yeah. And so, yeah, certainly there were some riders, not everybody, that was having issues with the track surface. Pretty much everybody said it was bumpy, but there were some that said it was bumpy everywhere, and then there were some that were saying, as you heard Nikki say, that it's bumpy in a couple of spots. And it's clear that all the riders were riding essentially the same track, although not necessarily, I want to keep this in mind, these same lines. And there was, and this is going to be a point of contention, and in fact, we'll hear even more about that in a bit. But as we know, the little drainage grates, because of the problems they've had with drainage there in the past, most notably 2008 and also a little bit in 2009 that they have installed, are kind of on the line where riders drag their knee. And they're currently, or maybe not even, maybe not now, but they were made of a plastic material that could actually deform under the weight of a drag knee going over it and catch, you know, a knee puck, catch worse. And that had been complained about by a couple of riders early on in the weekend. And so it's certainly something that the Speedway is going to have to take a look at and take a look at correcting. I know that... just as a point of reference, I talked to Paul Butler a couple of times over the weekend, and I believe that the FIM, perhaps with Dorna and maybe the IMS staff, I didn't quite have the full roster of who was going to be attending that on Saturday night. There was additional news that we should also mention, Jules, which is that this was, prior to this weekend, going to be, or was the last year that had been in the current contract. They have re-upped, and Dorna has re-upped with the Motor Speedway to run at least one more year. I'm sure there's an option for more after that. But I would well imagine that maybe one of the things that was discussed after Saturday was, could you please take a look at these issues and correct them?
Yeah. I mean, it's very rare that a track contract is extended for just 1 year. So I'm sure that it came with like a clause saying, and if you do these things, like fix the bumps that certain riders were complaining about, a further contract can be drawn. Of course, there is also the Texas racetrack that's being, is it finished yet?
Yeah. They haven't even started cutting for, they're still drawing up plans, but I do want to point out that there are, when we say, okay, that Dorna may be putting down some ideas about what they want to see have done. At the same time, IMS also is looking at what they would like to see as well. Not only marketing promotional things, but it's important to them to have a high profile event. While they're doing a great job, I think, promoting and marketing it within that area, I think some of that's actually also going to need to come from probably Dorna to help build up the image. Because frankly, as I had a conversation with some folks from IMS, notably Paul Kelly and a few others, that, you know, it costs an awful lot of money just to open the gates of that place.
And a lot of people have you know, made a point of pointing out that the stands were a lot less full than in previous years. Now, while it's true that certain portions of the track had some empty, like completely empty stands, I have to say that on race day, there were some extremely packed stands, and they would just happen to be under the place that had some shade. And I think that really played a big part of why there were some empty stands, because they were completely, open to the sun. And it was brutally, brutally, brutally hot. So I think the official head count, I think, was about 90,000 for the weekend.
Yeah, there really is no such thing at IMS as an official head count.
That's right. Yeah. No, I mean, this is the one that came out of Dorna, which I don't know how they gathered. It's, you know, whatever.
Sure. I believe the magic number was 62,000 something on race day. And so to me, at least, you know, certainly on race day, moving around, the place was crowded. And when you can crowd a place like that,
yes, exactly. Yeah. Exactly. On the ground, it was definitely crowded. In the marketplace, it was definitely crowded. In the paddock, I was surprised it was getting pretty crowded, because there was some ways of getting paddock passes this year.
There were paddock passes, and I'm not sure if they expanded that program beyond the hospitality, but there were certainly a lot of people with the neon green passes out there.
Not just the neon green, but there was another kind of paddock pass that I saw.
Yeah, I saw the VIP village people all over the place.
The VIP village people, were they all dressed up?
No, there was no leather fringe, no plumbers or anything like that. I'd kind of like, I would be tempted to actually go through that experience once, just to kind of see, just kind of being a you know, undercover, if you will, just to see what it was like. Because, you know, I did see them getting water around. And if you think about it, Jules, though, for somebody that has no idea what GP is about and also happens to have a fair amount of disposable cash, or at least wants to go to a race and not have to deal with any of this stuff themselves, it's a great deal. If you don't know anybody that actually is deeply into racing, or you don't have a racing friend, it's probably an awesome way to get introduced to the sport. Do you know what I heard this weekend too? Actually, I read it on GP1.
What's that?
Juan Pablo Montoya was one of the riders on the back of Mr. Momoa's two up this weekend.
Ah.
So a little F1 connection there for you, Grace and Todd, guys. We ran into them back and forth all weekend, including at
the Indy Mile. Yeah, that's right.
There's another thing I guess we could talk about incessantly.
We will. We will talk about it a little bit. Let's move on to before we get to QP, you got to talk to Lucio Cecinello.
I did. I talked to him right after FP2, and I guess this would be a perfect time to put that in there.
Sweet.
Jim Race here for MotoGPOD with Lucio Ciacnello from Indy Speedway. How are you doing, Lucio?
Yeah, not too bad. Enjoying Indianapolis, and I'm happy because it seems that the whole weekend we will have good weather.
Absolutely, and we thought it was going to be bad. You know, it's interesting. I've talked to a bunch of riders this weekend, and most everybody's complaining about track condition. Are you guys running into a bit of a problem with the bumps out there?
Yeah, our major problems at the moment is more belong to the grip.
Okay.
And especially the front grip. Our Randy, it's already, of course, penalized because he has his left leg, which is still recovering. But also he complained a lot about the front grip. He do not have the right feeling, and he couldn't stop the bike in a proper way.
Okay. So as far as Randy's recovery goes, mechanically we know the leg is fine. Is it a strength issue?
I mean, if we consider that Randy broke his leg in the third week of July, being here in end of August, you know, just after 1 month after the operation, it's something incredible. Normally, a normal people would stay, you know, lie in bed for a couple of months and then start to walk after 3 months. You know, and it's incredible what he is doing. For sure, he's still penalized because, especially in this track, because there are a lot of left corner, mm-hmm. and his injuries is on the left leg.
So you mentioned grip. The compounds that Bridgestone has brought for this weekend, do you think they're in a wide enough range to work for you guys in the afternoon sessions?
Well, the actual MotoGP rule allow us to use only Bridgestone tire,
sure.
and to use only two type of
right.
of tires. And when we, as now, we have to face a problem with the grip level, we absolutely need you know, to work with the material we have,
mm-hmm.
and then find the grip throughout other bike setup, like different springs, different damping in the suspension, and different weight distribution.
Okay.
It's not always that easy, but
sure.
We have to do our best with what we have.
A limited set of circumstances. Have you been making any major geometry changes to the bike, or is it just small incremental bits to try and find the ultimate ultimate running?
Yeah. On the first session, we realized that our bike was not well tuned. So this morning we did a few changements in the both bikes,
okay.
and we definitely are not happy. So we need we already make a new strategy for the afternoon with a big changement in one bike.
Okay.
And a few changements in the second bike. So Randy will have the option, you know?
Sure. All right, well, don't want to take up too much of your time. Thank you very much. Appreciate talking to you again.
Thank you.
Again, that was very cool. I kind of wandered up to the LCR. They had a studio upstairs, if you will, in the behind the standard paddock. And I just poked my head in and Lucio saw me and he said, gave me a wave in and sat down and dived right into it. Didn't want to take up a lot of his time, and it was clear that they were trying to sort out some issues with the bike. Word is that it's pretty much certain, and a bit that Lucio told me off air, that Randy will be back for 2011, and possibly with a 2-year, which I think would be pretty cool. And so that'd be great. That'd be awesome. I look forward to it. And I look forward to Randy getting back to full song as well, health-wise.
He was definitely hurting this weekend. I think both him and Valentino Rossi ran against some physical limits just due to the heat.
Yeah.
And the fact that they, you know, they lacked some of the training because of the, you know, they've been off their feet for a lot longer than these other guys.
Well, so, and on top of that, at least for Randy, as Lucio mentioned, this is a counterclockwise track, so he's looking at a lot of stress on the left leg.
Right.
So that's an additional burden for him. The return of Hiroshi was great to see, and he certainly or continuing that, he certainly had what I would consider a pretty solid weekend.
He did, definitely. And then in Moto 2, our friends at Mark VDS kind of shook up the world's order for most of the weekend. Both Scott Redding and Hector Fabel were at the top of the timesheets, FP1, FP2, and qualified second and third. So,
yeah, they pulled that off while having some of the slowest top speed charts.
That's right. You were pointing that out to me at one point. It was the finger was going down the chart because it's such a big field.
Yeah, where are they?
And like, I think Scott was like third from the bottom, right?
I think he was fifth from the bottom from QP. Or no, from FP1, FP2. I'm not sure. No, I think it was QP. The bikes that were at the top were the Paribamotos. What I really wanted to do, and I tried to do over the weekend, but I never could put it together, but I will still do it, is I want to talk to Michael Bartholomew, or maybe one of his top tech guys in that Moto2 squad, and get some additional ideas. You did have the opportunity to talk to the data gentleman, and a friend of our show, of course.
That's right, and Andrea Olieri, who we talked to, who I talked to in Brno, and we played that at in show 241. We kind of picked up where we left off, so take a listen.
Yep, we'll roll that. I also bent his ear really badly at during the mile, and that, you know, probably perfect time, Jules, to also roll the Scott Redding post QP interview.
Okay, sounds good.
All right, hi, with Andrea Olieri again from Mark VDS. This weekend is turning out really good for you guys so far, FP1, FP2.
Yeah, so far for us, it's been a good average, I would say, also for Hector.
Yeah.
And nothing. We are looking forward to the qualification that is in 1 hour and a half.
Yeah.
Hopefully it's going to work, maybe. I don't know about, you know, pole position and whatever, but the pace was the most important for us and was pretty good. So we are happy about the pace, that it's really important in the race vision, more yep. than, you know, just one lap and whatever. But yeah, no, you know, for the rest, Scott is actually pretty happy about the weekend. No particular drama till now, so
good.
We'll see.
Let's keep it going. I have a follow-up question from 2 weeks ago when we were in Brno. We're talking about the engines, and you mentioned that there's like an over-rev limit, only 1 second per lap.
Yeah.
And then over email, we were talking about, you know, on the downshift that doesn't count. So how is that measured? Do they know when you're shifting?
No, I mean,
part of the data? Like, how do they know that?
That, as I told you in Brno, the thing of the over-revving is a kind of gentleman agreement. It's not like there is a rule, you have to follow the rule. Okay. And by the way, in downshift, you never, I would say, for our rider, you never reach the limit there in downshift, because there is so many engine brake in there. You want to stay out from that zone. So you leave the engine drop a little bit down, so you start to downshift.
Do they clutch in, or do they?
Yeah. Sure.
So, they're really not pushing the engine that much when they're slowing down.
It's not like it can happen in 250, for example.
Right.
But sometimes they shift between they downshift between third and second, or second and third and first, very quick to use the engine brake. You know, because in that case there was no engine brake. So they were using the higher preamp to have in it.
Ah.
You know,
it's the opposite way around.
Yeah.
Interesting.
Here you have too much, well, not too much, you have much more. So you wanna stay a little bit out from it, and so you leave the engine drop a little bit to later on downshift. a little bit softer than you do actually with two strokes. This is for sure what it happened for all the guys. It's more soft, the downshifting, that it was in, you know, in the two strokes, because you actually can, the bike, it's a complex pitch, I would say. It's not complex, but it's more complicated. I mean, there is the weight.
Yeah.
Weight is much more now.
Yeah.
So you brake earlier. So you have more time, you know, to downshift and come into
good
the
point.
Corners. And later on, for example, if you take a look with 1 to 5, they completely like take off 3-4 gears, like bam, 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 bam. They don't care because there is not engine brake.
Right.
So you can brake and come in, there's not engine brake, the rear wheel stay there. Here you don't have any engine brake assistance, so you have to do it yourself. You have to do it manually.
Yeah.
No, there's no servo on any of those, you know, throttle body.
What about the slipper?
Slipper
clutch? Does it help at all? Yeah.
Yeah, it helps for sure. It's done for it.
Yeah.
You have to find a compromise that help yourself, you know, that you find a good compromise that help all the trucks, but usually I think personally it's much more a question of to find a good setting for yourself, and later on you can go on with that one without, you know, changing. You can change whatever you want with the slippery clutch. I mean, the engagement, the re-engagement.
Oh, you can?
Yeah, you can. There's a lot of tricky things to do. And actually, we struggle a lot. Not because it's not a good clutch. It's a great clutch.
Mm-hmm.
But we tried a lot of things, you know, to suit the clutch, the riders. So we try more engine brake, less engine brake. But when you find the right compromise, it's just stay on it. And because they can have back this feedback,
right,
everywhere,
right.
So they know how the rear wheel start moving in downshifting, and that you stand for that.
I'm gonna ask you a really stupid question. Why are you guys so much better at this track? Have you figured out what's going on?
No, I mean, you know, Moto2 is pretty crazy.
It is.
Yeah, it is. And I think.
But it seems like the first few rounds, teams were figuring out the setups, the riders were trying to figure out the bikes. Now they're starting to settle in, you start to see the same guys kind of
run. Jesus.
And then you guys all of a sudden pop up.
I gotta tell you that nothing changed for us.
Really?
Yeah, I mean.
Rider confidence?
Yeah, no, I tell you, with this kind of prototype chassis, you can do whatever you want.
Right.
So we did it.
Yeah.
And finally, we completely did a loop.
We back
tried
to where you started?
Everything, and we're back from where we started after the test, you know? So,
interesting.
It's not
this is a different circuit, too.
Yeah, it's a different circuit, but as I maybe told you before, Moto2, I think, main thing is riding the bike.
Yeah.
Not,
yeah.
You know, find the millimeter or the preload or the
right.
clicks or whatever. When the setup, the base setup is there, you just have to shoot your bike to yourself as best as you can. So it works. Because I tell you, we did nearly nothing between here and Brno.
Well.
So why not, you know? I think you just have to find the right way to have a good pace, and I think that's it.
You think it's a lot of it is in the mind of the rider?
I think so. Okay, you can help, but rider is always the most important part of the team. You know?
I heard one mechanic a while ago, I think, I forget what show it was, but they were talking about that a rider came in and said, my front end doesn't feel so right, and they they pretended they made some changes, but they didn't really change anything. He went out and he was he did much better. Does that happen to you ever?
Jesus, that's the whole story. I mean, that's an awesome. It never happened to me this year.
Yeah,
but it happened to me so many times.
Yeah,
but the guys came in. Ah, Jesus, here is too much. Here is, I don't feel comfortable. Okay, let's do it. You know, because riders sometimes have proper idea, so they want that you follow this kind of idea. That maybe they are right, maybe they are wrong, but when you recognize that they are wrong, you can't do it because it's a matter of safety, and you know. So okay, sometimes it happens. You do stupid things like you put more below than you take it back. So finally, it's nothing done. But he came in and said, "Ah, now much better," because he. He thought to be...
It's a placebo, basically.
Yeah.
It's
kind of placebo.
I love it. Yeah, like,
it's great.
Which really shows just how much the confidence matters, because I think that MotoGP really is becoming much more about the bike than about the rider. You know, I mean, it's still nowhere like driving a car, but it's not 80-20 anymore.
No, it's not a planet, but the bike has to be there.
Yeah.
And it's another way to shoot the bike yourself, you know. It's another book.
Yeah, well said.
Yeah, there is, I think it's more complicated for other things and easier for other ones, like engine brake or acceleration, like traction control or whatever, you know.
Right.
Here we don't have any of those things, so we have to do it like right hand and, you know, try to find the right lines and whatever. They're okay. You gotta work on that also, but you can shoot the bike yourself more with engine brake assistances and traction control. And all those kind of electronic helps.
Yeah.
That
yeah.
now are really cool.
Yeah. Okay, man, thank you very much again.
No problem.
And I hope to see you out tonight somewhere.
Yeah. Yeah, thank you.
Okay, and good luck, QP.
Thank you.
Both your riders are really doing well, so good
luck. Have to. Thank you.
All right. Thanks, dude.
Hey, this is Jim Race for MotoGP OD, and I'm here with Scott Redding, a Brit who has managed to, in Indy, qualify third for Moto2 today on the Mark VDS Racing Team Moto2 bike. Well done, sir.
Thank you. It was a bit wild out there, to say the least, you know. We had the potential to be on pole, feeling really, really good with the bike, really strong. But come to the end, when I had my new tyres in, it was just pure mobile chicanes everywhere.
Yeah.
I think I had a train of 12 to 15 people behind me at the end, you know, and it was just dangerous for me. But, you know, ended up third, still happy with it, a bit disappointed, but tomorrow's the race and that's where it counts.
It's really key, actually, in this class, although maybe not so much here, to be on the first two rows, because the pile into turn one is always a bit of a nightmare.
Yeah, here for turn one, turn one's not going to be too bad, but two, three, and four, it's going to be another story, you know.
Yeah.
There's a couple of guys at the front that haven't been up there, like towards the front most of the year, you know, and I think they're going to try to be hero in the first few corners, which could be a bit iffy, you know. So
yeah,
just have to see how it goes and try and keep the eyes open for the first few turns and then gas it up.
You know, I was talking to Kenny Noyes yesterday, and one of the questions that I asked him was, you know, is it in your best interest to be as far inside into the first corner, or certainly the second corner, as you can be, because, you know, otherwise you might get taken out if you're on the outside in the classic bowling ball move, or you might get lucky and make it around everybody else that crashes on the inside. It's like, it's a real gamble, isn't it?
Yeah, it's literally 50-50. You say that, you know, but if you're at the inside in Catalonia when you get the bomb going on the grass, then you got another problem, you know. It's whether people use their head or not in the first two, three corners, whether you get through, you know, but that's how it is, really.
Well, and it's part of the fun of it. It's interesting that they're going to, you know, pull six teams out next year, which is kind of weird in a way. It's great having a really full grid, but at the same time, it almost seems like it is a little chaotic, and there may be a little bit of disparity between the people in the front and the people in the back. What are your plans going forward? Are you going to stick with Mark VDS? You got?
Yeah, I'm hoping to stay with them. You know, contract's going to start getting sorted out next month.
Yeah.
But yeah, the team's been real great to me this year. You know, we didn't have a ride coming up to Christmas and come to New Year, and the Michael Bartomley rang me up and says he wants to take me on. So, you know, I took it with two hands, and it was a great team. Didn't know what to expect, and let's put this, it's like a six-star team, you know. Yeah. ex-MotoGP is 10 times better than what I've ever had before, and I really appreciate it.
Yeah, it really is kind of a unique team. I mean, they've got their fingers in a whole bunch of pies. You know, car racing, both of you guys running
Dakar.
Yeah, it's crazy, and it's cool. And Michael certainly has a whole lot of history, you know, back in the Cowie days. I was just telling him when I was talking to him, hanging off my backpack back in the media center, I've got an old Fuchs Kawasaki tag hanging off that. I always race Cowies, so I was glutton for punishment. excellent. So you kind of are part of a small crew of guys, and it must be kind of weird being away from your. I was talking to you before this about the classic video, the basketball video.
Yeah, that was pretty good, you know. When I had Eugene as a teammate, we had good fun, you know.
Yeah.
I had a pretty good year that year, my first year. Eugene had one or two good results, but not a good bike. But, you know, we had good fun, and like I said, the basketball video was part of it.
Yeah. You're still holding that record, aren't you? The youngest kid ever to win.
Youngest ever to ride, and youngest ever to qualify in the front row. And I held quite a few records at this moment in time, you know. But
they're always meant to be broken.
Yeah, I'm hoping they're not going to be broken, you know. We work real hard for them, and, you know, it's great to have them. We don't feel any different, but when you see it in the books and stuff, it's great to see.
Yeah, so, you know, you finish up qualifying third. Doesn't sound like you're entirely happy with it.
No,
I'm
not happy, you know, but because we had potential to be pole, I felt really, really good. I felt really comfortable. The bike was moving, but, you know, it felt stuck to the... Okay. It's the American tarmac, you know. But
all of the different American tarmacs?
Yeah. But in the end, you know, we just had 12 to 15 riders behind me, and it was getting out of hand. And in the day, it was just dangerous for me and also the other riders. So,
yeah.
You know, third's still good. It's the front row, best result. I think it's one of my best qualifyings in my career in the World Championship as well. So, you know, I think qualified second in 125. Third year potential to be pole, and I've got a good race pace.
So it may seem like you kind of like this bizarre little racetrack.
Yeah, I love it.
Yeah.
I don't know why. It's just I've always had a good feeling from the word go with it, you know.
Yeah.
I don't know if it's the people that sort of similar language to me, and the atmosphere is just great.
Yeah.
I don't know. It's just little combined things like that which make a big difference.
Cool. Yeah, you remember in 2008, how many laps did they cut off at the end of that thing when it started going crazy?
I think that was... I don't know.
Was that two or three, maybe, something like that?
Yeah, that was something ridiculous. But even then, you know, I was going for a podium. I missed the gear. I'll come out third. And going to fourth, I was going third, third, third. And then Bradl overtook me.
Yeah.
0.002 over the finish line. And then they red flagged it. Went back a lap. And I ended up fourth.
Were you guys getting blown to shit out there?
It was hard to remember, but it wasn't too bad. It was just more... starting to spit a bit, you know.
Yeah,
more than the wind, but no, it was definitely a bit loose.
Yeah, well, come GP time, I'm watching like trash cans blow across the track, and I'm like, folks, red flag. Alright, so what do you think your chances are for tomorrow?
Well, we've got good race pace. I feel really comfortable, been training hard, so the fitness should be good. You know, there's no reason why we can't be on the podium and even push for the win, you know. So
that'd be pretty damn cool. It's about time that you...
Yeah, that would be nice. Start getting some good results now to thank the team in a way, you know.
Sure. You want to throw some thanks out to anybody?
Yeah, I'd just like to thank the team for giving me the chance this year. Shark Helmets, Red Bull, Fab Racing, Kiva Motorcycles, and everyone that gives me the support out there, you know. It's great.
Cool. Right on. Thanks for coming on, and maybe if we get a chance, after you're on the top of the box tomorrow, we'll talk to you.
Yeah, hopefully. Thank you.
All right, very cool. Again, it's great to hear from Andre again in a different situation, but a very cool context. I don't think I mentioned to Scott that we'd talked to Andrea. It was funny when I saw Andrea in the paddock, and he was like, I don't remember you, which was fine from 2 years ago. Well, I think he does now. Just like I said, spent a bunch of time chatting at the mile. Scott was very cool. He wasn't quite happy with his spot, which is pretty impressive, but he felt he had the pace come race day. But race day would prove to be very brutal for an awful lot of riders.
Oh, yeah.
But it's probably good to talk about a little bit of stuff that went on in QP, because we had some surprises there as well.
Definitely.
I don't even, you know, we should probably just talk about the one that kind of blew everybody away and work our way down from there.
Let's do it.
Ben Spies takes pole at the Indy round. There's no doubt that over the last couple of races, he's been pushing to the fore. I really have to wonder back to, and I never did get a chance to really talk to him this weekend, and I kind of feel bad about it, but talk to Tom Houseworth and, you know, see how much he was really pulling my leg. I do remember that in the press conference, Thursday press conference, that Colin mentioned something along the lines of how they ended up with a little bit of a magic motor at Laguna, and how that has carried forward. Now, whether that has spread across through both sides of the Tech 3 garage, I don't know, but slip-ups like that, not even a slip-up. That, I don't even think Colin knows how that will. But something's going on over there, and I think it's very cool. Now that we know that Ben is going to the factory team, now that we're hoping that Colin will return, he certainly had a good weekend. And you know, this is really actually great for Hervé Poncherolle and that whole team, because for years they've kind of been the redheaded stepchild, and it seems like they're really coming into their own.
Well, at least a couple of years now. I mean, they've had, so Colin's been on that team for, what, 3 seasons?
Ever since the bikes were no longer yellow and weren't running Dunlops, the team has really come forward.
Yep, exactly. So it's fantastic stuff to see a satellite team do really well, and, you know, to be challenging for, first of all, getting a pole and then challenging for the race win. Unbelievable.
Yeah, we were quizzing ourselves after that, weren't we? Who's the last satellite American to get on the box? And then, so let me give you the front row. We'll just start with that. We had Ben Spies on pole. Middle of the row was Jorge Lorenzo, right? Oof, this is bad for me. On the outside of the front row was Nikki Hayden.
A very, very happy Nikki Hayden, who got a special prize, I think, for being on the front row.
Did he?
Yeah. His special prize was a little ride around the oval.
Oh, that's right. I think he might have gotten that anyway, but yeah.
I know. That's what you said. The QP was conference was very, very funny, I thought.
There's probably no doubt that Tissot might have given him a nice new watch, too. So that was cool. And, you know, as we rolled down the grid, you know, Danny was back there just a little bit. We kind of had a little bit of a standardization wandering back through the grid. I don't think there were any surprises beyond the front row, were there?
Well, there were surprises that we had Stoner, who was actually on very good pace most of the weekend, and Rossi on the third row. This is worst qualifying of the year.
That is very true. However, those guys, for the most part, certainly Ross
falling down a lot.
Yeah. and so that's an awful lot to get through. I'm going to throw out a disclaimer for both Jules and I here right now, just so you guys understand. And this is kind of an ironic thing. And I guess it should explain why, without going into way too much detail. A, when you are actually at a race circuit and you were covering a race, be it either through photography or through running like a chicken with its head cut off through the paddock, trying to pick up interviews or get information. It's pretty funny, but there are often times where you don't get to see a lot of the race. It's true, isn't it, Jules?
Absolutely. For me, it's, you know, I come home and I look forward to being able to watch the thing on MotoGP.com, because until that point, I have no idea how it really unfolded. I just know looking at jumbotrons and thankfully, like Indianapolis has like 3 different places where they show the standings, the numbers of the riders, and that's pretty much it.
Yeah, and I do the exact same thing through that, and then I bring home basically a large folder of papers where I can actually look at the chronological analysis of the laps and kind of get an idea as to what happened. Now, that being said, for the events that transpired early on Sunday, kind of all that, the wind got blown out of both our sails, and we probably have not done the necessary duty to make, I have not yet rewatched the races besides what occurred while I was there. Am I missing things? I'm sure I am. And I don't think I'm going to apologize for it. I just want you guys to know.
Right.
So, but we still know stuff.
There is the web.
There is the web. All of that talk aside and a little bit of wandering, and imagine that from the two of us. I did also get a post-qualifying interview. And this one, though, however, is after Casey's gotten a good eye at the track, including from very close range. And he talks about a whole raft of things. And in fact, this one is one of the best ones, at least from a Casey Dramatica point of view.
Okay.
Let's roll.
Let's roll this one. This is good.
Yep.
So it was a little bit frustrating.
But no problem with your knee for the race?
No, luckily I expected there to be some more issues with my knee, but it ended up just being a muscle down in my calf that's going to be the biggest issue, and that's no problem with my riding, so I'll be fine.
And what's the issue with the front end? Is it similar to what you've had, or something different with these new forks?
You know, how to explain? I mean, it's nothing to do with the forks. It's completely geometry problems. We've had it all year. You know, we get the front end to a point where it feels fine, and yeah, as the weekend goes on, it sort of seems to get worse and worse. And we don't know what it is. We'll try something for tomorrow, but I can't go into any more detail about that, to be honest.
It seems that there have been more crashes in all the classes this year than I can remember in the 3 years of this event. Is the track deteriorated since the first event?
Well, I wasn't here last year, so I've had a two-year break to really understand how much it's deteriorated, and personally it's a huge difference. I mean, you know, it looks like somebody's gone out there and done a bit of concrete work and a bit of tarmacking themselves, you know. It's doesn't look like a professional racetrack in the slightest bit, you know, with that many different types of tarmacs, different, you know, patches here and there, bumps that haven't been repaired, and, you know, it's definitely not up to the standard, I think, of what Indianapolis's name should hold.
Is this something you'll bring up in the safety commission meeting?
I already did yesterday, but, you know, basically, you know, knocking on wood, there's no way to get through to them. So.
We spoke to Valentino, who crashed at turn six with a bend crash yesterday.
Mm-hmm.
And he said the bump there, he's brought that up, and it's something that really needs to be fixed. It's a big problem.
Like I said, you know, like 70% of this track needs to be resurfaced. Not just that, you know, it really needs to be ripped up, smoothed out again and resurfaced. The curves on this joint, you know, we don't need all that, you know, all those drainage points in there, because by the look of them, I haven't had to go on and have a close look of them. They do look like they're made out of plastic or something. And, I mean, you know, it's not hard for them to be caved in and pushed down. And, you know, there was another spot where there seemed to be, like, a gap between the curb where Valentino went down this morning, I think, and the tarmac. And, you know, your sort of knee gets hooked in there sometimes as well. And it just, you know, you may as well be riding around the streets. And I'm sure, except for around here, you know, a lot of streets would be probably smoother than this joint, so... It's not much of a racetrack.
Valentino said the bumps are like street bumps, not race.
Yeah, well, that's it, you know. I mean, you can get a bit of an idea driving around the streets here, what it's like, and in a car it's a heck of a lot smoother than what it is out there on a bike, so, you know, I don't think there's too much of a difference between the bumps out there and in here.
Without giving too much away, where are you finding the team is actually working
well? We've had a fairly balanced package most of the season, and I wouldn't say it's any different. There's no particular point it's working well at. It's no particular point it's not working well at. So we've, you know, just trying to get the most balanced bike we can, and, you know, qualifying was kind of interesting there, but there's a lot of people that I think during the race tomorrow will sort of slip back down the order. They're just not capable of running times, and We'll see what people come up with tomorrow, but on race tyres and race pace, things are quite a bit different, so we've got to also increase ours in this hot conditions, but we'll see what happens tomorrow anyway.
So where are you?
That we don't know. Depends on conditions tomorrow. You know, weather forecast can say whatever it wants, and until you actually see it and see what it puts out, what sort of temperature it does, we don't really know. Tomorrow we've got a few things to try, and we're not too far off race pace wise from the fastest, which is Danny and Jorge. But you know, we could do with being a few tenths quicker than what we are. So we'll see what we can come up with tomorrow, and we should be able to improve the bike a little bit. I don't think so. I mean, we're able to use the hardest tyre here, so I don't think there's going to be any issue for the tyres. Unfortunately, the hard tyre doesn't seem to be working so well in the hotter conditions. It seems to work well in the colder conditions, so it just doesn't make any sense at all. And it's, you know, seems to be like for most of this year, you know, in a hot place we have to use the cold tyres, in the cold place we have to use the hard tyres. So it's just, you know, it doesn't seem to be making a lot of sense.
There was, like, towards the end of the session, there was maybe some communication going on with some of the satellite Ducati riders.
Just one. He's in my way every opportunity he gets. Since he rode my bike last year and, you know, thought he was going to get on a factory bike and it was going to be so much different to his, he's kind of had a bit of a chip off the shoulder with me since then. So every chance he gets, he'll come over and ride as close as he can to me and try and hit me, try and just slowly wipe me out. Or if he pulls out of the pits in front of me when I'm on a hot lap, he'll just sit in my way, make sure he completely screws my lap up. So, yeah, it's getting close. So I'm, my patience is wearing very, very thin with him. And, yeah, I'm fed up with it, to be honest.
Because that final lap of qualifying, were you trying to go for another lap, or were you...
No, to be honest, that was my last lap. Felt the tyres already going down. I wouldn't have been able to do much more than what I did. Not enough, anyway. And
what's the meter still got in the way early in on that?
No, basically, I mean, you know, they're waiting for me to get a tow, and I'll screw them up as much as I can. You know, they're going to get in my way when they're waiting for me all the time. And basically, I just went into turn one, turn two, rolled off the throttle. And as I pulled wide in turn three to let them all pass, he's come right up next to me within, you know, less than a foot away from me, trying to look him that way, trying to make he wasn't trying to do it. So it happens all too often, and yeah, I'm just fed up with it, to be honest. So I was a little bit disappointed in Barbera as well. Going into the last turn, he just sat where I basically needed to get wide enough for the last turn. But anyway, you know, I'd pretty much blown that lap. I'd spun up a little bit too much coming out of those fast last turns and just didn't have the traction.
Those are the three for Casey for the week. So you guys have enough Casey from this episode to keep you going for a while, but I do really find of interest the transformation, and it's a transformation not only of understanding how the bike is going to deal with the track and what the possibilities for running at the front are, but also the frustration at not being able to put the effort together. Now, how much of that is actually related to potential movement movement for next year? And I've also kind of heard this, you know, I don't think there's any doubt that both, for example, Casey's team and Valet's team are working their tails off because everybody wants race wins. And frankly, as a mechanic, as a logistics person, as a data person, whatever, results still matter at the end of the year, regardless if there's going to be a shift in personnel. So.
You know, Dennis Miller sometimes says, stop me before I sub-reference again.
Well, true. Yeah. Okay.
So you sub-referenced like three times. I just want to make sure that everybody's clear what we're talking about. We're talking about the fact that, you know, Casey is moving to Honda next year, and there has been a lot of, I think, kind of cruel suggestions that he's not trying as hard because he's done with Ducati. And I think that's total BS. I think that the Ducati has changed, and it's difficult for Casey to be able to get pulled off the results that he used to be able to pull off, and that's the simple of it.
Yep.
You know,
and Casey's are also running a bit of a Franken bike in a way, because he's got parts from 2009, he's got
that's right,
primary bike from 2010 with some speculative 2011 parts on it. So that's an awful lot to deal with, and it's all in an effort to push the bike forward so that they can have something that is prepared to go. for 2011. And in doing so, in a way, he is, although you kind of wonder how much, there could be some classic conspiracy theory and intriguism, if you will, developing that for, you know, the next guy that's going to have that bike being Valentino Rossi. I also wonder a little bit if Felipe Preziosi doesn't have, you know, some little bag of tricks for Rossi when he comes in.
Hmm? I mean, Rossi has already said this too, is they're going to start from scratch, kind of. Like, they're going to bring the bike to its base settings, everything, you know. I really think that the reason why the Franken bike exists is not because they were developing in 2011, but because they want to get some wins before the end of the season. I mean,
yeah.
There hasn't been a season, think about this, there hasn't been a season where Ducati has not won.
That's a good point. You know, there one of the reports
since you know, coming back in 2003, basically. So,
well, there's still plenty of time, and it seems like this weekend as well that some of the tension had been occurring between Valentino and the Fiat Yamaha team has cooled a bit. Still no word on the Valencia test, but I'm guessing that probably by the time that comes around, there will be, I think he's probably going to ride. And I thought it was very interesting what Casey said about Valentino having the opportunity to ride and how really that was good for Ducati.
Right.
First and foremost. So, yeah, we'll see. Yeah, that was a whole bunch of Casey enlightenment this week. And it pointed out to me once again, what you said after you'd gotten your recordings in Brno, when he's just kind of talking about stuff, he's very kind of cool to listen to. It's not that, you know, those pat answers. So,
Right. You mentioned the whole Fiat thing. We still don't know about Jeremy Burgess and the rest of the crew. We still don't know about the test, and there was some talk about having an extra test, in November, which would also, if Yamaha wanted to be really cruel, they would bar Ross from that one as well, which means he would actually be missing two tests, which would be pretty nasty.
Yeah, I don't see it happening.
I don't see it happening. Yeah, you're right. I mean,
I did hear rumors of, and I'm not even sure, and I would have to look at the calendar to see that it was from two fairly well-connected sources that Jerez might be returning for a test, which I thought that'd be pretty fun. We kind of missed GP0 a little bit in a way, don't we?
Yeah, totally. Totally, with the whole QP off, whatever. That was a lot of fun.
They have to have GP0 in 2012 with all the new bikes out. I mean,
well, anybody who started watching MotoGP in the last year,
yeah, what we're talking about.
Yeah, in previous years we used to have a pre start of the season event with the official test. It was called the official test, and during that test weekend they actually ran a QP session at the very end, during which the riders competed for a BMW. It was always the BMW that they were competing for, right?
Yeah, like a 5 Series or whatever the newest
one
was.
The latest one was. So we kind of got to see. It was sort of designed, I think, in a way to kind of get people to stop sandbagging, you know? Although I think there's still some sandbagging going on because, I mean, after a while, it's like, you know, do I really need another BMW? Some of these guys, but...
Well, yeah, pretty much Casey walked off with most of them for a while.
Oh, man, he was just year after year. So, yeah, so that'd be great to see that event come back. It was a great way to kind of get energized for the season, especially when we're starting the season a little bit later. So,
you know what? I also think that was a great promotional vehicle for them, especially considering of how many races we're looking at right now where World Superbike has been waving their flag for like a month and a half. And we're
exactly, yeah.
You know, and so folks, that's the reason we call it GP0, because it's about as damn close to the start of the first race as you can get. And it was, there was a competition of sorts during that event. If you haven't seen it, I highly suggest you figure out a way to go back and see them from seasons past. We've had a few really interesting ones, including a massive rain spattered one and a few, It is still early spring there in Europe, and in the Europe, did I say, where they have the history, and very, very, very cool. And I'm looking forward to having that back, and I hope they do bring it back. I think we need to run through results and we get out of Dodge. What do you think, Jules?
Let's do it. Let's do it. Let's go through 125s, which is actually was a very interesting race, because Marquez was back on pole. Mm. However, he fell during a couple of laps into the race, got back on the bike, fought his way back all the way to fifth, I believe, but made a mistake and cut across the track, and which allowed him to actually catch up to the group to get even closer and pass a couple of riders, and he didn't. He was penalized. Mm. 20 seconds, I believe, right?
Yeah, which
ended up putting him back down to 10th. But what this means is that it brought the championship, which was starting to look like a Marquez runaway, very much back into contention, because we've got Nicholas Tyrrell, who won this round, and Paul Espargaro within 5 points, both of them within 5 points of Mark Marquez.
Yeah, and it, for the most part, the 125 race itself, except for a lot of the unintentional excitement, was a little bit, at least for me, what I could catch. You know, actually, I can't say that. I can't say Jack until I actually rewatch the TV stuff of this. So I'm going to take that all back.
But
all the races were great.
But it was, I was worried that we were going to lose the one championship that still looked very, very much in contention.
True.
And we got it back. So that's going to be the exciting to watch the next couple of rounds. Nicholas Tyrrell, who was completely looking like the guy that beat in the beginning of the season, then had a bunch of really, really bad luck and a couple of offs. Became kind of a race between Marc Marquez and Paul Espargaro, and now the three of them are back, you know, like I said, within 5 points. That's a win in the second place, so great to see that.
And we've our next round is round 13, so that means the season's winding down, and when things are tight at this point, we really do hope it hangs on and stays that way. So
absolutely.
Why don't you run through Moto 2 for me?
Well, Moto 2, the first thing I went from Friday, I think on Friday, Dan Lowe, who you mentioned earlier from a Corner Speed photo, who, by the way, I think wins the award for the best photos of the weekend from Indy. No, I'm serious. I mean, he really went overboard. He's a fantastic photographer. I've always liked his stuff, but this was his breakout, I think. He was just clever. We'll link to his website, because you have to check out his photos. They were clever, creative, and of course, great on track action as well. So
I don't think Dan's going to be able to get out of his house after he listens to that.
But his head, you mean?
Yeah, exactly.
But one thing I was telling him on Friday was like, oh yeah, you know, I'll see you in at turn two in Moto 2. And he was like, oh, why? And I'm like, well, don't you want to, you know, catch the quote-unquote action? And so, yeah, so we went to turn two together. And, of course, there was a huge pileup. And, you know, there's a slow corner, so nobody got hurt. But it was red flagged because there were just too many bikes sprawled all over the place.
There literally were a pair of pileups.
There were two pileups, yeah. There was one small one with, like, two riders, and then one with, like, seven or eight of riders, and it included, you know, guys that you know, included like Roger Lee.
Mm-hmm.
It included Tamazawa, who unfortunately suffered enough damage, and not himself, but the bike suffered enough damage that he was not able to restart.
Yeah, the key being, and I'll remind you guys of this, is that Moto 2 is a class these days that only gets to have a single machine ready to go. And
yeah,
and on top of that, there is a point that Jules will get to shortly, or one of us will, that you have to have your bike back within 5 minutes of the incident, ready to go. And there was kind of something interesting. Go on, keep going.
Well, actually, I'm not really sure what you're talking about. So you're going to have to fill me in on that one. The race was restarted.
It was, but let me finish that thought then.
Yes, please.
Because what occurred, and this was very specific to Roger Lee, was instead of going the traditional route, which would be running, in this case, counterclockwise around the track, he actually rode backwards from turn two, ran through the pit exit as an entrance.
No way.
Yeah, came back into the pit that way. Well, it was certainly the shortest of two options.
Right. But completely illegal, isn't it?
It is, by definition, not allowed. Hmm. It, however, may have been the safest option at this point. It's clear the corner workers gave him the freedom to return to track, to return to the paddock. The decision to go back by that much more direct method was probably one that, you know, he just said, hey, you know, I got to get back. And this 5-minute rule about returning, if you've been involved in a crash that cut out, Espargaró and Bautista, when Depuñé got taken out a few races back, was the same thing that Roger was looking at. But yes. The difference being, as I mentioned before, and this does key into that, is if you've only got one bike, it's not like you can get back to the paddock, hop off your A bike and get on a B. You only have an A bike, right?
Or ride a scooter over.
Well, you can ride a scooter over, but still your bike has to get fit.
No, that's what I mean. That's what I mean.
Yeah.
So I did see that some riders got scooters to take them back, and the crew came out and brought the bikes back because it was pretty close to the start. So
yeah.
Some bikes went through the infield. I mean, it just seems kind of weird. That rule seems weird. We'll save it for some other time to really like dig into it if it happens again. But those bikes took some interesting ways back to the pits, and a lot of them restarted because really only two bikes were not allowed to restart after the red flag.
Yeah, I mean, the turn two can be a cruel mistress because we lost Rossi last year when he went off there.
Yeah.
But at the same time, if it happens at a relatively slow speed, you can end up, you know, just kind of, you know, picking a couple of chunks of grass out of your fairing and moving on.
And literally, nobody knew really who was at fault. That was probably one of the funniest moments of the whole weekend was that there were a bunch of the riders got up and just started arguing about whose fault it was.
Liking to blame somebody. You know, I'm going to do a little history walk back here, and I'll try and make it as brief as possible. I remember in 2003. 2003, I think I was working Laguna Seca, working turn two. And I think that was the Aaron Yates bowling ball incident where he took out a whole bunch of riders, maybe in World Superbike Race 1, I want to say. And Hodgson was down, Keeley was down, a bunch of other riders were down. And this is turn two downhill, and it's very, very close to the paddock exit, almost exactly carbon copy situation, if you will. Only on different sides of the country where we had at Indy. And it was kind of funny seeing once the Dragon Wagon, the vehicle that takes the bikes back to the paddock, picked up some of the bikes. These guys basically just sprinted back to the paddock up the hill and right back in and just zipped in there. No scooters, no nothing, you know, and there was almost a little bit of a 100-yard dash race going on between a few riders, all of course in full leathers. I remember that when Keeley crashed, he was limping around and looking for a ride back, and he couldn't find anybody to give him a ride back. And then somebody ran past him, and all of a sudden his limp was gone, and he was able to keep up with the other gentleman that was beating him back to the paddock. It was a very funny story, and we all got a laugh out of it.
Awesome. I love it.
Back to today.
So anyway, but then the Moto 2 race got restarted, and it was actually I did follow it for quite a bit, just over the last, because, you know, one of the highlights of the weekend was that Toby Moody was, announcing the,
yep,
all the action. And, this is the second year he's done this in a row, and it was really, really cool. He's such an incredibly animated guy. And to hear him all over the speakers, the PA system at Indy was just awesome. Final results, I think that, you know, we already mentioned Scott Redding had a good weekend. He finished third. He was actually running for second for a while. Julian Simon came on very strong. He was leading the race for quite a bit. Tony Elias did take the lead and keep it to the end. So he's really pulling away in the championship lead. This is, I think, the third race he's won in a row.
Mm-hmm.
I think that probably for us the most awesome result was seeing Jason DeSalvo finish ninth.
And I think there were an awful lot of people that were surprised, and many even more that were very pleasantly surprised. It was a great run by him and a very good team. Very good team. He had a little bit of a hit squad in there as far as knowledge and information goes. I do have to say, at the post-race press conference, you guys have already heard the post-QP one from Scott Redding, but I did a very brief bit with him right after the podium press conference for Moto2. And when
we'll play it now then.
Yeah, we should roll that, but when he and Elias walked into that press room, my first thought was just take him to Clinic Mobile. They both looked, yeah. I mean, Scott had to be helped by two people up onto the thing. Tony looked like he was about to have a heart attack. And in fact, there were a few riders that actually had some health issues just from,
exhaustion. I mean, yeah. For them, remember they were on the grid twice.
True.
They had to do two warm-up laps and still do a. I mean, that was not a shortened race.
No, but, well, it was. They knocked it down to 17 laps, but it was still
okay.
Yeah, it still was certainly brutal times. In fact, I think during Moto 2 was the hottest part of the day.
It was, and on the podium, I mean, it was sweat was pouring off those guys. It was obviously a painful. Experience for them.
And in fact, Lewis had actually started the weekend with a bit of fever, and I remember seeing him walk by me on Friday walking through the paddock, and he had his head down and just looked pretty pale, and seemed to be, at first I thought it was a limp, but I think it was just basically he was like bloody hell. But to do what he did was magnificent. There was a really cool photo I saw today from Martin Heath Photography. He took it from the very inside of turn one, right at the end of the Aramco. And it's just the pack about to come streaming by him. And you can really get the essence of the speed and the not letting off these guys do from the start finish line heading into one. I mean, it's just, it's like game on, and it really actually kind of epitomized Moto2 for me. Very, very cool. Martin Heath Photography, folks, if you don't know, and I think you can find that online.
It didn't look like you could even stay under draft.
Yeah, we was out in the race, and luckily it was down to 17 laps, because the energy and power was just going down very fast. But we was out in the race when the tyres was good. We had the drive, but coming out of the last corner, I was a little bit faster than them. But they changed the second gear and they're pulling. And we always suffer with the top speed, and it makes it harder for me, But I guess it's from where I'm a little bit tall, a little bit heavier, and the team do everything they can to help this. And, we're trying everything we can. Also, the rear was starting to slide a lot towards the end. And then I was using my head to control it, and then this took more energy. And then I couldn't get second gear out of the last corner. The power shifter just wasn't working. It was just, I had to close the gas, and then it would unsettle the bike, which also didn't help for my straight line speed. And we had a few little issues, but we finished the race. Weren't in such a good condition, but who cares? I've made a podium, and that means a lot.
Yeah, you and I talked yesterday, and there was you were talking about your new fitness level that you've come up to. Was there a certain point, like midway or three quarters, that you knew you were going to be knackered and just had to dig deep?
Yeah, I was digging deep from the last 8-9 laps, and then them last four laps, I just could not push no more. That was everything. I couldn't breathe, and my hydration pack was coming through warm. But, the training level needs to go up another gear. I'm only 17, and these guys have been racing a lot longer, and they're getting used to it, and It's my third year in GPs, you know, and already in Moto2, so definitely taking it the harsh way, but if that's what it takes to get to the podium and in the future win, then that's what I'll do.
Great race, man. The surprises out were not, frankly, that many. There were some classic names. I was really bummed to see Rathbart Willerat go out. You know, he's like my dark horse underdog guy.
Me too, totally. Me too. And he was doing very well in FP1, FP2. His qualifying position was not the best. I think he qualified just outside of top 10.
Second fastest trap speed. It's something to take home.
I guess, but that's the bike, really. Oh no, he qualified seventh. He qualified seventh. That's pretty damn awesome. Next to Tony Elias on the second row. Yep.
Kenny Noyes, welcome back. Nice having you on last week. We're just finishing up qualifying today. It's been a relatively long weekend, and we got through not quite where you want to be. You're looking at the timesheets now and getting an idea of where things laid out. Tell me about your afternoon.
Yeah, it was pretty frustrating. Today went a lot better than yesterday. Yesterday we had a clutch problem that held us up about half the session. Mm-hmm. So I only got like 13 laps out there. And our bike was set up way too stiff.
Okay.
So we changed suspension and this morning went out and felt much better, you know. Improved a little bit, but we didn't use any of the stickier tires, I guess.
Okay.
We got two compounds here, and one of them's not working very good for us.
Yeah.
So we used those in the morning just to kind of work on setup and saved our two good tires for the afternoon.
Okay.
And then I went out on my first tire. Felt real good right away. In fact,
you hit a 47.7 on your third lap.
Yeah, 47.7 third lap, and then my 10th lap was my fastest.
Yep.
Which was before putting on the second tire. You put on the second tire, went out, and that's usually when you go faster, you know.
Yeah.
And the beginning out there, there was a lot of traffic, a lot of guys waiting for tows, and it was kind of complicated to get a good lap in. I also got behind DeBone, and I thought he was going to pull hard, and then he shut off halfway through the lap, so I lost about, you know, two or three laps there messing around with guys. And then the last laps, I had Elias right in front of me, and he's usually a real good tow. And the first lap he messed up, and I decided to stay behind him because, you know, he's usually a good bet for, especially we're having a little bit of trouble down the straightaway, so yeah. It's always good to get a draft. And I got behind him on the last lap, and then turn two, Ricky Garduce, Spanish rider, just ran into me and knocked me off the track. So
literally.
Yeah, he was, I don't know, he probably overshot his braking or something. But, you know, the result is we qualified 30th, and, you know, I feel like we could have done a lot better. Because, you know, Tony, I think on that lap, did a 46, maybe 6, or 46.5. So, following him, even if he took a few tenths on us, you know, we'd still be at least like a low 47, which would put us in a much better place on the grid, and I think a better... more where we should be, because I got a pace of 47s, you know.
Right.
So,
yeah, looking at your ideal time, you're, like, solidly in the low 47s consistently if you had a clear lap.
Yeah, it's just sometimes it's hard to put it together, you know. And it's here I really wanted to, you know, and obviously sometimes just wanting to is not good enough, you know. You got to have everything fall into place. And, you know, it's going to be tough tomorrow, but I know I got a pace that's a lot better than some of the guys in front of me. So just got to be patient, try to get a good start, and then just be patient and try to pick them off as the race goes on.
It makes me wonder if upper mid-pack, third or fourth row, is probably the least ideal place to be going into two here.
Yeah. Anywhere back from the first two rows, or maybe row three is still okay, but anywhere back from there is not ideal.
Yeah.
I mean, last race in Brno, I got taken out in the first lap, so... I'll start at the second lap. You know, it's just not a very good group to be in at the beginning of the race. But, you know, sometimes you can, you know, you can't look at it like it's going to be a catastrophe.
Yeah.
But, you know, you just got to, it's hard to be careful in the middle of that group. You know, you be careful, and then you can still, wind up getting hit from behind, or, you know, you just got to go for it and hope that everything, you know, clears out.
It's kind of funny because the bottom line is that every track you're going to at this point for that configuration motorcycle is different. It's one that's never run at that track, or maybe run at that track, but certainly never with 40 whatever bikes going in the first couple of corners in anger. And so you really never know what's going to happen, and you can't gauge that from, you know, QP or whatever. You just don't know until they all fall in.
Yeah, I mean, talking to Randy Mamola once, he told me that he never really had a plan coming off the starting line, aside from just getting a good
falling
jump.
Yeah.
You know, his plan was getting a good jump and then reacting to what happened.
Right.
I mean, if you get a hole shot, then you can have a plan. I'm going to go high. I'm going to, you know, I'm going to get.
Yeah.
But if you're in the middle of a pack and you have a set plan, then something happens in front of you. It messes you up. But you got to just be there and ready to react and go find the hole.
Yeah, it's like the mental part of instead of target fixation when somebody's going down, like plan fixation, if you will.
Yeah. Yeah. Exactly. So you just kind of react to what happens and.
Yeah.
You know, Bruno, until I got knocked off, first, you know, start was really good. So hopefully here, turn one's wide, and then turn two, and especially turn four, really tightens up. So kind of where you are on the track at that place is, you know, on the track, that's kind of where you're going to be.
So let's wrap up QP on a high note, because we certainly do get to. We're heading off to the mile, dude.
Oh, yeah, we are.
That's going to be cool.
It's cool. I haven't been out there since I raced. I did the pro singles race, I think, in 2000 out there.
You haven't been there in 10 years?
No. Yeah, it's a long time.
You're going to have an itch, aren't you?
Yeah, I'm looking forward to it. I saw Chris Carr walking around and talked to him for a while. And, you know, I got a lot of friends out there, so it'll be fun.
Cool. Well, I'll be over there too, and shit, it seems like half the paddock's going to be there.
Yeah.
Maybe more. All right, well, listen, you have a great day tomorrow. Good warm-up and final solution, and I want to see you come around at least on the first lap and preferably on the last.
Yeah, for sure. For sure. I mean, I think we play our cards right, and we're a little lucky we can still get in the points, and that's our goal in every race. So.
I think so, too. All right, well, rock it out, dude.
Yeah, thank you.
So that's Moto 2. Let's go to MotoGP, which was a typical MotoGP race, unfortunately. Kind of decided, except for fourth position, it was pretty much decided.
It's hard to generate a whole lot of excitement about.
Yeah, yeah. Well, okay, let us be excited, because the start of the race was cool, because Spies did jump, not jump, but he got a fantastic start. He made the best of his pole position, and he led the race for. Seven laps before Danny finally caught him and passed him, and then basically Danny was just too fast for Ben to do anything about. Lorenzo never came anywhere near Spies. In fact, afterwards, Rossi said something really funny, which was now Lorenzo has his own Lorenzo to worry about.
He's got his own Jorge.
I love that. That was great. The real battle really was between Dovizioso, Rossi, and Hayden. And Hayden, why don't you lead up to what we were talking about earlier, because that had a big impact on Hayden's race.
Yeah, no. That was kind of amazing, because the one thing that many of the riders were complaining about, specifically once again, as we talked about before, was those plastic drainage grates caught Nicky out, and it caught him out in a big way. It ripped off his knee puck, which was, however, dragging a bit. It tore his knee puck off, but he still had a fair amount of the race to go, and he still had a fair amount of knee to drag. It started off just dragging leather. It actually got to a point, and God bless the boys from OWB, but he was literally dragging knee while racing, and he knew it. He was not doing it, obviously, to the point where it would do massive, massive damage, but as he was wearing through his leathers, at a certain point, it got through and gave. And this was a cumulative thing, not immediate. It was something that happened over time as he was continuing to race and race well. So those are big ones, Jules.
Oh, yeah. Oh yeah,
very
big ones. No, I mean, and we're kind of running out of time, so let's finish this up and then talk about the Indy Mile just really quickly.
Okay.
But yeah, I mean, he showed his balls a lot. I mean, not literally.
let's quickly run through who went out in the order in which they did. So, Melandri, Stoner, Edwards, and
So Melandri went out, and I don't even know why. And I'm not going to try to pretend that I know why. I just know that he on the result sheet he was out first.
Yeah,
Casey Stoner crashed in T10.
Mm-hmm.
Colin Edwards pulled in. He had massive issues with his rear tire.
I believe it was his rear.
In case I mean, you know, we need to bring this back, but he was very, very close. He is very, very close with the Lenz family and was very affected by Peter's death that morning, and even considered not riding. So. I think he raced with extra weight, a lot of extra weight.
Indeed. And, you know, frankly, most of the GP riders knew about this going into the race. And I think the track handled it as best they could. I'll leave it at that. So, yeah, four guys out of the race, which means he had 13 left and everybody that could finish was going to be in the points. So,
yep,
good for them. Not so good for the guys that did not end up the bottom of the, you know, the bottom six guys that did complete 8th through 13th. No big surprises there. This is your 8th through 13th. Simoncelli, Bautista, Espargaró.
Well, I think we should give some props to Bautista, who has had such terrible luck. I mean, he finished ahead of his teammates, which is pretty rare.
True.
And he ran a pretty damn good race.
And he finished.
And he finished, yeah. And he did finish.
I mean, very cool, certainly. And up at near the pointy end of the Privateer group, Bautista is probably going to be staying. I think that's most certain. Elias may possibly become Suzuki. That is actually becoming something that people are going to start talking about big time. Everybody's like, it'll kill his career. I don't think so, because it is a bit of a gamble if you can get a 2-year contract, which is probably questionable, but have the opportunity to see what they can come up with in 2011 with the new formulas. And you're not going to find me betting against Suzuki coming up with an i4000. I mean,
the other thing is that I think Elias really has a chip on his shoulder about not being a MotoGP this year, because he is one of the few riders of a very large group of riders who has won a race, you know, and who has had been on the podium many times. So I think that it's a kind of a valid chip. Although, you know, I just feel like if you can win a championship or two in Moto, if you can win two championships in Moto 2, that would be really solidify his position.
When was the last time a chip on your shoulder helped you win a race?
I don't know. I've never raced with a chip on my shoulder or raced. Anyway, before we sub-reference too far off into the future, Espargaró, Loris Caparossi is probably going to Pramac.
Mm-hmm.
So he'll be back to Ducati in a weird way. And I don't know whose seat he's going to take, but it's probably going to be Mika Kallio, because Elias Espargaró has kind of come back to form, and he definitely was the guy to watch last year too. So
yeah, the key is in that team staying on the bike.
Yep, exactly. But the final finishers were Danny Pedrosa, Ben Spies, Jorge Lorenzo. Rossi did finally catch Dovizioso and was able to keep him at bay, and he actually looked like he may have been able to gain on Jorge. He even said that he was going to try it, but he realized that his physical condition was just not going to be able to put up with it, and he was just in danger of crashing yet again. He had, I think, was tired of crashing at that point. So he finished the race a good 6 seconds behind Jorge. Dovizioso was fifth. Nicky Hayden, a very brave sixth. And then I think we already mentioned Simoncelli, which was actually a good, really damn good finish for Marco at this track. And Bautista, Sago, Barbara, Caparossi, Aoyama, and De Punier.
Yeah, I'm going to thumb my nose at Martin and say, I think your boy's playing safe there. What's up with that, Martin?
I think so. He's playing smart. That's safe. Smart.
Yeah. Okay.
All right. I really would like to talk about the Indy Mile just very briefly, because yet again, I think this year for me is the memory from this year is going to be just the variety of atmosphere that I got to see at the races. And, you know, Laguna Seca, like I mentioned in a couple of weeks ago, Laguna Seca and Brno and India are already very, very, very different types of venues, different kinds of crowds, everything. But to throw the Indy Mile in there, it's like the ultimate, right? I mean, talk about a throwback to the 50s. And I don't mean a throwback in a bad way. I mean, in like the most like nostalgically wonderful way, magical way. The Indy Mile is just every... I just cannot believe that I didn't go there in 2008. That's what I'm going to say about like...
Yeah, no,
it's great. Last year was incredible, and this year was incredible again. It's just something. It's just amazing.
I've been to a bunch of miles over my life. I went to San Jose Mile multiple times. I went to Sacramento Mile when I lived up here in the early '90s, and so I kind of had a little bit of an inkling about what it was all about. I mean, one of the first races that I can ever remember attending as a very, very small kid was at Ascot down in Southern California, which is very, very famous. Small track and bred a lot of top guys, many of whom went on to road racing glory. But yeah, no, it was very cool. You know, and in fact, you and I had a very homey experience there. I mean, you know, trying to deal with our passes.
Yeah, that was kind of a waste of time. I'm really sorry about that.
No, to be honest.
In the end, we didn't really need to go through all that.
I'll be honest. That was cool. You know, we found a guy that was cool, and he helped us out, and he cruised us around and wanted to chat with him. Real race fans. And,
true.
And, you know, and at the same time, as we're wandering about, we're running into MotoGPOD fans at the track. Hey, come over, have a beer. You know, I mean.
Right. Yep. Shout out to everybody there whose name we forgot since. I'm sorry. And of course, all the teams who were there.
Yeah, that was what I was just going to say. I mean, you know, you went around the corner and there's, you know, all the teams and, you know, Carmelo Ezpeleta. And Ducati had a massive presence there, which is, this is a lead-in for you, Jules. Because they also announced that Nicky Hayden had re-signed for 2 years, and it was Del Torchio that actually announced that. This is very surreal. Del Torchio, who is the CEO, I believe, of Ducati Corsa, announced to the Indiana State Fairgrounds crowd at the Indy Mile that Nicky Hayden had just signed a two-year extension. The crowd went nuts. That was cool. Talk about it. That is odd. That's... I mean,
what a weird, yeah, definitely very strange.
Yep.
And then they took it. And then they brought out a Ducati powered, a Desmo powered oval track racer, flat track racers. That was awesome.
And he got on it.
And he really got on and stayed on it for five laps.
Yeah, that was big fun.
And we're not talking about Del Torchio, but Nicky Hayden.
Yeah. Well, I think probably a few people got lit that night. It was very much fun hanging in the infield and having a great time and getting pelted by dirt clods and even rather patiently being yelled at by the fairgrounds officials to please step back from the fence. I mean, you know, there's this massive temptation to, you know, like get right up against the Armco and watch these guys come around. But there is not only an element of danger, but an element of kind of blocking the corner workers. But that was fun. The only downside of that night was you and I trying to find a cab well past midnight.
And it was still like 80 degrees out. It was crazy.
Yeah, that was the only good part of that. I think we were the last to actually leave the entire fairground structure. That being said, we got home and or got back to the hotel, and I took up residence as the king of the lower lounge downstairs, and
I slept.
And you slept, but great time. Yeah, the mile is just a blast. You know, next year we can cap it off even better. We do arena or an enduro cross on Friday, also at the fairgrounds. You want?
Yeah,
fill that up. A great weekend. Obviously, a downside to it. We do have some more racing coming up. If you think we're done with indie events at this point.
So yeah, I mean we have Misano MotoGP, and we've got Nürburgring and World Superbikes.
Yep, a whole bunch of stuff going on. You know, we probably don't even need to go into detail because we're going to have so much information coming. Once again, these doubles are pretty crazy. I do want to at least throw a mention out too, because Martin, a couple of things that Martin's doing. Martin is meeting up with James Witham, and that should be on a show shortly. In the same vein and part of the world, Caldwell Park ran its second race this year for BSB. Tommy Hill and Josh Brooks split wins across those two races, so good on them. Michael Laverty, I believe, took a fourth and fifth. Do we really need to go into the ring or the second ring, if you will? I guess it's the big ring. Or Misano, or just say, hey, there's a bunch.
We'll talk about them when they're done.
Okay, I can do that. I can do that. It's not like we're light on content this week, is it?
Nope.
Yeah.
So before we go, I just want to just say, you know, I've had a very retrospective kind of last few days as you know, things started to hit home about Peter Lenz's death at the track on Sunday. I kind of was, you know, it's retrospective because I'm a father and I do believe that, you know, we do try to always keep our kids safe, but, you know, the whole, I'm just going to basically read a quote that I found, which is a quote from, Helen Keller, yes, the Helen Keller, which is, and this is the quote, that security is mostly a superstition. It does not exist in nature, nor do the children of men as a whole experience it. Avoiding danger is no safer in the long run than outright exposure. Life is either a daring adventure or nothing. And I think that really just applies well to the Lenz family and what Peter and Michael were up to, and it just kind of helped me kind of put a cap on it for a bit.
Very cool. Yeah, it's definitely been one of those weeks that you can't take back, and I know that anytime I think too deeply about it, yesterday I went back and listened to last week's show, and that was tough. You know, you and I talked, Jules, about maybe not even doing the show, and I think we both felt it was the right thing to do in the end, and I feel the same way now. And I just want to express my love and support to Michael and Jennifer and everybody else there, also to Xavier, the other writer involved. He'll get well, folks. Anything that we here can do, not only as a show, but as just friends of you guys, please ask. Liam, same way. Love you all, and we'll get through this.
So thanks for listening, and sorry to end on a sad note, but that's pretty much the way this thing unfolded. So take care, everybody.
Cheers.
MotoGP is a trademark of Dorna Sports SL. The MotoGPOD podcast and MotoGPOD.com are not affiliated with Dorna Sports SL. All other trademarks are the property of their respective owners. MotoGPOD isn't affiliated with any of them.